Support for this podcast comes from Avangrid. Tom Turnwald runs an Ohio millwork company that was started by his father and employs his kids.
I'm in favor of wind farms because I'm committed to attracting talent to our community, and the school districts with wind turbines get resources that can make a huge difference in kids' lives.
Since 2012, an Avangrid wind farm has strengthened the economy and contributes millions to the community each year. To learn more about where energy meets humanity, visit avangrid.com. That's avangrid.com.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, what a dinner party in Washington, held months before Donald Trump decided to run for president, tells us about the origins of his sweeping immigration plans today. And part two in the story of Sammy, the young refugee from Afghanistan who made a dash for the United States, uncertain whether the president's executive order on immigration would block him from becoming an American. It's Tuesday, February 28th.
Thank you very much, everybody, for being here today. It is with great pride, very great pride.
There may be no more powerful tool in helping to carry out Donald Trump's agenda than the Office of the United States Attorney General.
That I say these words to you right now, Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Welcome to the White House.
In choosing former Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, Trump found a man who has long held a very particular vision of immigration. A few years ago, Sessions met someone who shared that vision. Back then, neither could have imagined how quickly their views would go from the fringes to the pinnacle of American government. The story starts at a party that they both attended.
This is a September evening in 2014, and it's at what's called the Breitbart Embassy.
Breitbart Embassy?
Yes, indeed.
Emily Bazelon is a staff writer at the Times Magazine who focuses on the law.
This is a mansion near the Supreme Court, and Stephen Bannon, who's now one of President Trump's chief advisors at the time, was the CEO of Breitbart. He lived in this mansion, and they threw some swank parties at it. And this particular evening, there were other various conservative figures on the guest list, including, at the time, Senator Jeff Sessions, already someone who was fairly close to Stephen Bannon. And they had something to celebrate. It was kind of the tail end of the effort in Congress to pass comprehensive immigration reform, which would have provided a path to citizenship to some undocumented people. And Sessions and Bannon were very much opposed to immigration reform, and they had helped in succeeding in killing it. So that was sort of in the air that night, this sense of excitement about the death of immigration reform.
How had the two of them together killed or helped kill that comprehensive immigration reform?
So Jeff Sessions was the farthest to the right on immigration in the Republican Party and the farthest to the right in the Senate. And he was on the Senate floor more than anyone else.
It will definitely give amnesty today.
Flogging the criticisms of this bill.
It will definitely give immediate legal status to some 11 million people today.
And Bannon at Breitbart was covering what Sessions was doing in very flattering tone. So, you know, really giving Sessions a lot of play. And there was a writer at this party that we're talking about, Reed Cherlin from Vice. And he said to Sessions, you know, just kind of interviewed him sort of as a courtesy, because these were folks at the time who didn't have any power. But Reed asked him what role Breitbart had played. And Sessions said, you know, you might not think it, but they really helped kill this bill.
So for many of us, this is kind of a surprise that these two people know each other, they're at a dinner together, that they've been thinking and coordinating together. Donald Trump is not even really thinking of running for president. And I have to assume there's no thought in the minds of Steve Bannon or Jeff Sessions that he's ever going to run, or that if he ever did run, that he would win. So given how unlikely that candidacy was back then, Where was all this going to be going in its absence? Where was all this immigration planning and thinking supposed to land?
Well, I think, first of all, they were just hoping to promote this agenda against immigration. But in 2015...
One of the intellectual, moral leaders of this populist nationalist movement in this country, it is Senator Jeff Sessions, Republican from Alabama. Senator Sessions, thank you so much for joining us.
Bannon started a radio show for Breitbart, and one of the first people he interviewed was Jeff Sessions.
Senator Sessions, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I am going to put you on the spot. This thing's so confusing, the immigration, the trade, we're trying to go through it, you know, different things, people are saying different stuff.
And he said to Sessions, maybe you should run for president.
Are you open to running for president of the United States so these issues become front and center? Yes or no?
Well, I've never thought that that's
you
the thing
the
for
right
me
guy.
To do.
And Sessions demurred, but, you know, that would have been another way to promote their ideology.
So you take these two guys, and they really don't have anything other than each other and a dream, and then Donald Trump arrives as, I guess, kind of a gift from the heavens?
I think that's right. I think he was a really long shot bet that neither Sessions nor Bannon thought would pay off, and yet it did. And it paid off in the best way possible for them, in the sense that all along through his candidacy, if there was one thing Trump was clear about, it was that he shared their agenda against immigration. Sessions is the first senator to endorse Trump, and he helps craft an immigration policy for Trump. And the messaging is really important to both of them, too, and something they had been working on separately from Trump.
Question. Do you believe, not just for the people coming and the economics of it and how much it's costing us, this is deeper than that. This is about if we do not stand up and have this enforced like it was laid out, that this is about the rule of law, and if we lose this, we're going to lose it all. Do you still believe that?
Absolutely. We are eviscerating the will of the rule of law.
Which they then essentially can hand over to Trump, and he has his skills as a television star to promote that message.
We are going to restore the rule of law in the United States.
So let's fast forward to the inauguration, and Trump is beginning to assemble his White House. Jeff Sessions, based on that early endorsement, could presumably have had any job he wanted in this new White House. Help me understand why someone like Jeff Sessions, with the views he has on immigration, would want to be Attorney General, and how he could start to use the power of that office to put the vision that he has into place.
The attorney general is the chief law enforcement official in the country. Sometimes we call the person in that role the top cop, but you really can't underestimate how much authority he has. As attorney general, Jeff Sessions oversees the nation's immigration courts. And that means that he can decide how many judges there are going to be and where they're going to be. One of the things that it looks like we can expect from the executive order about immigration, the most recent one, is a surge of judges to the border. And the idea is to really ramp up the number of expedited removals, they're called, that the country's doing, where we afford very, very little due process to people before we turn them around. Another is that as Attorney General on his own, he can review recent decisions by the Bureau of Immigration Appeals, and he can say, I don't like those decisions. I don't think that particular group of kids from Honduras really is threatened by gangs enough to merit asylum.
Single-handedly.
Yes. It's really, I know, a striking power of the Attorney General. And then I think another really important thing to remember is that the Justice Department, through the Office of the Solicitor General, defends all of an administration's actions in court. And so the legal arguments we're going to hear defending these executive orders, these also come from Jeff Sessions and his Justice Department.
Let's end with a question about where this White House, at the zenith of its power on the issue of immigration, might take this country over the next year and then maybe the next 4 years. Where do you think the Sessions-Bannon-Trump plan will go?
I think that their plan relies on scaring people because it is so expensive, so divisive, and just literally unfeasible to deport millions of people. We have 11 million undocumented people in this country. But if you scare people and make their lives miserable and they go home on their own, then they're essentially doing your work for you. And so I think we're going to see some aggressive steps, and we're already seeing them, to make undocumented people feel afraid.
That's the concept of self-deportation, for which Republicans used to be mocked.
And no longer are.
So if you don't deport them, how do you send them home? Well, the answer is self-deportation, which is people decide that they can do better by going home because they can't find work here because they don't have legal documentation to allow them to work here.
And so Mitt Romney said this. It became a comment that he was derided for in 2012. But Sessions on the radio talking in the past year about Trump's plan and how he was possibly going to fulfill his promise to make millions of immigrants leave, he said, you're going to have to self-deport.
You basically would have a self-deport if you want to become get a legal status in the United States.
And so then the question becomes, what does that look like? And it's starting with unbinding the hands of ICE agents.
Homeland Security and ICE officers and Border Patrol have the lowest morale in the government because they're being denied the right to enforce the law. And it's very critical.
And then I think a second front that hasn't yet started, but which I'm going to be watching carefully, is what happens to sanctuary cities.
Like New York City.
That's right. So many big democratically run cities across the country are promising that they are not going to cooperate. They're not going to be commandeered into handing over their undocumented population. One of Trump's executive orders directs the Department of Justice and Homeland Security to look for ways they can take money away from cities that don't comply with this new immigration agenda.
And that sounds like a pretty extraordinary measure. But in some ways, isn't that Jeff Sessions just doing his job?
Yes. Normally, the attorney general's job is to defend the actions of the president. They're both in the executive branch. They cooperate and coordinate. There have been moments in our nation's history, specifically Watergate, where we really deeply craved greater independence from the attorney general. But most of the time, in the ordinary course of government events, the attorney general helps the president carry out his will. And that is what we are seeing here. And I think it's also important to remember that this agenda was very much laid out in the campaign. It should not actually be a surprise to people.
Thank you very much, Emily.
Thanks so much for having me.
The American people are on top of this. There's a movement out there. Whatever happens, we need to be sure that the message is clear that this matter has got to be fixed. It's a disgrace to a great nation.
Senator Sessions from Alabama. Senator Sessions, I know you're incredibly busy today. Thank you so much for joining us here on Breitbart News Daily.
Thank you.
By the way, I'm still going to pester you about running for president, so don't worry. I haven't given up yet.
We'll be right back.
This podcast is supported by Amelia Perez, Zoe Saldana, Carla Sofia Gascon, and Selena Gomez, star in director Jacques Audiard's audacious, genre-defying movie, hailed as the year's best picture. An electrifying odyssey boasting tour de force performances, liberating song and dance, and bold visuals. The London Standard calls it a work of brilliance. Time hails it an exuberant ode to human possibility. And Vanity Fair raves, there is no other movie like Amelia Perez, a thrilling reminder of the limitless potential of this medium. On Netflix in the US, UK, and Canada.
Many think of beauty and health as disconnected. But beauty and wellness are really two sides of the same coin. Hello, I'm Isabella Rossellini, and in the final episode of This Is Not a Beauty podcast, we'll hear from a cancer survivor, an anthropologist, and a carer of the elderly about the relationship between beauty and health. Listen now on your favorite podcast platform.
Hey, it's John Chase.
And Mari Uehara.
From Wirecutter, the product recommendation service from the New York Times. Mari, it is gift-giving time. What's an easy gift for someone like under 50 bucks?
So in our Gifts Under 50 guide, we have this super cute palm-sized Bluetooth speaker. It comes in an array of cool colors. It's waterproof. You can bring it anywhere. I want one for my garden.
I love it. Check out all of Wirecutter's gift recommendations for yourself and everyone else at nytimes.com/holiday guide.
Come on.
A few weeks ago, we told the story of a 16-year-old refugee from Afghanistan who'd been left an orphan after his mother, father, and sister were killed by a Taliban bomb. A boy we had first spotted in a photograph, who was hours from being resettled in the United States when President Trump signed an executive order intended to temporarily stop refugees like him from entering the country.
Sammy?
His name is Sammy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Good. Where are you?
And we ended that story with a revelation.
I'm in America now, yeah.
Yeah.
He had made it to the United States. In the 2 weeks since, Sammy has found himself somewhere between the life he wants and the one that he left behind. Hey, Joe, how are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Thanks for coming on again.
My pleasure.
Joe Cochran is a Times reporter in Jakarta who first told us about Sammy. Joe, last we knew, Sammy had made it to the United States. What can you tell us about how he was able to get in?
He arrived in Los Angeles and was met by officials from the International Organization of Migration. And when he arrived, there was no issue with him entering the country. Some people were detained, other refugees and green card holders and others who were trying to travel to the U.S., visitors, but he was not. He spent a night in a local hotel near Los Angeles International Airport. I spoke to him briefly by telephone, and he was obviously very tired, but he was very elated to be there. I said, "How are you feeling?" Mm-hmm. And he said, "I feel," and then he paused for a few seconds, and he said, "Wonderful." And he told me the next day he was flying to Washington State. And from the contact I've had with him since, he's in a, basically I would describe it as a boarding house for refugees who have been accepted by the United States. They're all minors. I was texting back and forth with him as best I could and spoke to him briefly. So far so good, but it's not a complete, not a complete happy ending, because he's still hoping to get resettled with a family, because he has no family. He's an orphan, and I don't know if that's going to happen. Some of the very last text messages I had from him was asking me for help to find him an American family to take him in, because he was not entirely happy at the boarding house. He said it was boring. There was nothing to do. He's unable to work right now. He hasn't started back to any type of formal schooling. So it's pretty much touch and go. After initial elation, I think it's sort of settling in for him that, he's still got a bit of a difficult road to go.
Why has he not been resettled with a family, or why is that not something that's already in motion?
I'm not entirely sure. It's difficult for me to find out the full extent of that. I am inquiring. It wasn't necessarily a case where he had to be resettled with a family. He's 16 and a half years old. Maybe the situation was as such where there was no family to come forward to take him in, as they might with a younger child. The boarding house he's in is run by a nonprofit organization. They have staff, they have caseworkers, they have full dining facilities, security. So he's not living on his own, but I can see his point of wanting to have a family, because otherwise he's on his own except for maybe some of the few refugees he's met. So that's a question I'm still trying to figure out, whether he could be adopted. A number of families have contacted the New York Times offering to take him in, but could they do that? Would he be able to travel to a different part of a country to be with a family that might want to take him in? And is that in his best interest? So, these are some very serious questions. I'm doing my best to find out what his options are.
You mentioned that he is not yet enrolled in school. Why isn't he formally in a school yet?
I think the situation is, he's been on the ground in the U.S. for only a month or a little more. So I think there's a process that has to play out. And he also has to be evaluated. He's been out of school for more than 2.5 years. So a lot of assessments have to be made in terms of whether he can try and get some equivalent degree or maybe go to vocational training. Something like that. It's, these things have to play out.
So what exactly is his legal status right now?
His legal status is that he's a accepted refugee, and he has now the legal right to live in the United States and eventually work, and he's on the path to citizenship. Obviously, that's, about a 7-year process, I believe, or if
wow.
not longer. But his status is clear.
You've become quite invested emotionally and journalistically in the story of Sammy. And I wonder what you think the lesson of his journey to the U.S. really is.
Wow, that's interesting. Yeah, I certainly have become emotionally invested. You always try and remain neutral and a conscientious observer, but you know we're all human beings, and you feel for this kid. You know, he fled Afghanistan because he was targeted for death. He was a minority Shiite Hazara, and Hazaras and Shiites have been targeted for death under the Taliban regime they were, and he made a very a very hard decision to leave his country and try to get to somewhere safe. So especially with a young man who doesn't pose a threat, you know, he's someone who I think eventually could help make the country a better place.
Well, Joe, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. All your help and all the work you've done to help us understand what happened to Sammy.
Great. No problem, Michael. Let's keep in touch. I would love to speak to him at any moment, but it's not easy to always get through to him. I've tried. So hopefully I'll be able to talk to him again tomorrow.
We've spoken to Sammy by phone and text message over the last few weeks. He's recently decided he's not ready to tell his story. We told him that dozens of listeners had reached out to ask about him, wanting to know how he's doing. Sammy wrote us back and said, thanks to them. President Trump's executive order limiting refugees from entering the U.S. has been halted by courts, and it is no longer in effect. Here's what else you need to know today.
I'm on a Trump train because I believe in the principles of Donald Trump.
Hundreds of Trump supporters are rallying across the country to demonstrate that their confidence in him has not wavered.
Everything that was written about him, everything that was perpetrated by the media towards him was a false narrative. And I just couldn't believe so many people fell for that.
And to counter what they say are unfairly negative portrayals of him in the news media. And the last Republican president, George W. Bush, is breaking his silence about the Trump presidency.
We need an independent media to hold people like me to account. I mean, power can be very addictive, and it can be corrosive, and it's important for the media to call to account people who abuse their power, whether it be here or elsewhere. One of the things I spent a lot of time doing was trying to convince a person like Vladimir Putin, for example, to accept the notion of an independent press.
Right.
And it's kind of hard to, tell others to have an independent free press when we're not willing to have one ourselves.
That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.
This podcast is supported by ACLU. The ACLU knows exactly what threats a second Donald Trump term presents, and they are ready with a battle-tested playbook. The ACLU took legal action against the first Trump administration 434 times, and they will do it again to protect immigrants' rights, defend reproductive freedom, safeguard free speech, and fight for all of our fundamental civil rights. Join the ACLU today to help stop the extreme Project 2025 agenda. Learn more at ACLU.org.